Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Investment Insights. Today's episode is called Megatrends 2024. This is an annual podcast where we update you on seven long-term structural changes to society and the world. Just a reminder, this podcast is general advice only and is not intended to be specific to your personal situation. If you do want to discuss your personal financial situation, you can book a call with me or one of the advice team at nucleuswealth.com/contact. Today, as always, we have Nucleus Wealth's Chief Investment Officer and co-founder and star of the show, Damian Klassen. Damo, welcome.
Hey, Sam. How you going?
I'm well, thanks. My name's Sam Kerr. I'm the Head of Advice at Nucleus Wealth. Just a reminder, the themes discussed in this podcast are a reflection of our thinking, which we implement across all our active portfolios. You can find out more about our offering in the description notes below. This show is a pre-record. Normally, it is recorded live at 12:30 Australian Eastern Standard Time, but we are having a break over the holiday period, so it is a pre-record. Usually, you can jump onto the Nucleus Wealth YouTube channel and ask any questions that come to mind during the show, and we'll do our best to answer them during the presentation. We are also available on all major podcast platforms, so feel free to tune in there if you prefer. And those are all the intros out of the way, so Damo, over to you to get the ball rolling.
Thanks, Sam. So, yeah, I wanted to start with the back to this idea of these long-term trends. And so what we've got in these long-term trends is, I'm using a relatively famous Ray Dalio illustration. So it's a similar type of factor. And it's basically saying that we've got three different trends are sort of folding into each other. One is this longer-term trend that we can see, which is like this, you know, line going from the bottom left up towards the top right, and it's just rising steadily every year. And then you've got these short-term trends that go over the top of that. Now, in the Dalio speak, it's a debt cycle, but that could be, you know, more sort of shorter-term economic cycles as well. And then you have this longer-term debt cycle, and that's this, the big sweeping lines. And so what we're really, the key bit to get out of it, though, is that underlying trend that we're seeing, you lose sight of that for long periods at a time where you go through these big trends, and the small trends. And so what we're really trying to do is look at some of these longer term trends that have just been driving markets for sort of 50 years plus, and looking at those trends. And we like to have a look sort of once a year at what we call the big seven trends, and talk about which ones of those have really driven economies for the last 50 years, and where are they headed at, what part of the cycle where are we at now. So the first one which we're going to jump into is this idea of inequality. Now, the last sort of 40 or 50 years have been really good to the top 1%. So they've been, however you want to measure it, whether you're measuring by income, whether you're measuring by assets, the top 1% really has gone from owning a significant portion of the world markets to an even greater amount over time. And that makes a big difference to a number of different things. So the key one that makes a difference to is demand. And so why that makes a difference to demand is when you give the poorest person in your country another $1,000, chances are that they're going to rush out and spend that straight away. If you give the richest person in your country another $1,000, chances are that's going in the bank. And so there's this economic concept called the multiplier effect. So the person who's rushed out and spent the money, well, that's just become somebody's income, say at a grocery store. That person at the grocery store is then paying some of their employees, and they're out spending that money on, you know, movie tickets or dining out or school fees or whatever it is. And then each of those people is doing the same again and again and again. So you have this real multiplier effect. When somebody sticks the money in the bank, you don't get that multiplier effect. So that money doesn't keep going through. And that's part of the reason we feel that we've seen this era of lower and lower interest rates, where central banks have been struggling year after year to get interest rates higher, because they've got this problem where the top 1% is getting more and more of the money, and they're just saving that money. And so you're not getting, you have this sort of weak demand that we've been looking at for this long period of time. And this trend really doesn't look like it's being reversed anytime soon. So we had glimpses, I guess, during COVID, where we saw a lot of transfers to some of the poorer parts of society. We have seen reasonable wage growth in the US. Having said that, the wage growth has often been, the US has sort of just poked its head into some real wage growth, but if you look at but it has been negative in terms of the actual real wage growth. And what I mean by that is, you might have got a 6 or 7% pay rise, but if inflation was 8 or 9%, then you are actually going backwards. In Australia, it's been even more so the case that real wages have been negative. You've been going in a sense of versus inflation, you've been going backwards. Whereas asset prices have ticked along relatively well over the last few years. So yes, big long-term trend, very much sort of leads you to the idea that deflation and disinflation will continue to be a problem while this trend is in play. And if this trend reverses significantly, then we can actually see further bouts of inflation and sustained inflation. So where are we at now? Look, it does look like we're heading back to more of the same as what we saw over the last sort of 10, 20 years. There's a reasonable argument that given the fall of communism back in the 90s, what that sort of led to was that in the years, say, from 1960 to 1980s, we had capitalism, but it was relatively constrained capitalism in that it wasn't allowed to run rampant, because if it ran rampant, then next thing you knew, there was a revolution and communists were being installed in the government. So capitalism had to be relatively constrained. In the last 10, 20 years, there's a reasonable argument that the shackles have come off a little bit, and that's why we're seeing more and more, less and less pushback. We tend to see both sides of politics are both out there trying to make everything easier for businesses and push through, lessen the regulations. So, yeah, that trend doesn't look like it's reversing. There is the potential, maybe, that some of the lessons from COVID might be that if you give money directly to consumers, that is actually quite helpful for economic recoveries. The only problem there is that we saw a pretty good bout of inflation, and I think they're certainly from some of the more economic think tanks, and you'll see stuff coming out saying that, that was why. You should never have given the poor people money, because next thing you know, we'll get inflation. So keep giving it to the rich people, because otherwise you don't get the inflation. So that's our long-term trend number one. The second long-term trend is demographics and the idea of the baby boomers pushing through. And so that was the baby boomers, a group post-war in the 1950s and 60s. There was a huge sort of burst of new babies coming through. And what that meant was that sort of cohort of people pushed through. If you sort of tracked what they were doing at each sort of section of the time, going, okay, these people are all at school, and so that means the types of goods that teenagers want and things like that, that's what you should be selling. That was a good market. And then as they moved into their early years of work and starting to look at settling down and getting families, and so the idea was then, okay, now if I'm selling houses and bits and pieces like that, and then as now they're getting into retirement, is the idea if you're out there selling goods that sort of suit that market, then that's a good thing. So the big issue though with these with having such a large cohort of people in there as being so important to the rest of society, and so that sort of pig in the python, so to speak, moving through the demographics, is that for a while there, and we've got this sort of showing on the chart, this group of people were detracting from economic output in that they were children, they weren't actually out there working, they were going through and studying and so not actually adding to the economy, but they were a cost in terms of being there. Parents had to feed them and house them and clothe them and things like that. as they moved into work, we got this productivity boost because all of a sudden the number of people we had that were working relative to the number of people not working suddenly rose quite significantly. And that's the trend that went on for sort of about 50 years. We can see on this line, there's sort of two lines on there. Well, sorry, there's three. One is the overall level. The top line is a child dependency. And so we can see that's been falling fell quite sharply into the 80s and then has sort of tailed off from there. The one that's rising quite quickly, though, is the old age dependency. And so this is the part where what we're looking at is as the baby boomers are retiring, there's now fewer and fewer workers supporting a bigger and bigger population base. So we've got this huge tailwind as the baby boomers moved into the workforce. Now we're starting to see that turn into a headwind. And so that's coming up over the next few years. I've got a UR here on that graph, and we can see that that's a, you know, we're into the phase where that's rising. It sort of turned maybe about 10 years ago, sort of the early 2010s in the US, much earlier in Europe and Japan, and it will come later in other countries, some more developing countries like places like India. But certainly those dependency ratios for developed countries is becoming an issue and is turning from what was quite a tailwind for a long, long time into a reasonable headwind.
And Damo, I guess, what is that actually going to look like in society? Is that less tax revenue generated, or, you know, how does that actually play out?
Question about whether the absolute level of tax changes, probably not, and it probably might even need to go up. But it does mean that the tax burden is going to be going to fall on a smaller number of people. So you're going to have a smaller number of people paying taxes. In the past, there's been a real push for taxes on income rather than taxes on things like property and investments, and potentially that may need to be looked at, because if you have a significant proportion of the population who are, say, retired, and in Australia, there's you're in pension phase, you can get rid of a lot of your taxes, and in the US there's certain benefits as well from a tax perspective that goes to retirees, is that you end up, you know, the people that have all the assets aren't paying the tax, and a smaller and smaller proportion of people is needing to generate enough to pay for all the police and firemen and nurses and schools and all those types of things. So yeah, you would expect to see, if that was continuing, you would expect to see greater political upheaval as well as that sort of comes to a fore.
Okay, and the chart, it's obviously US centric, but obviously mirrored in Australia and other countries.
It's a little bit better in Australia, because our immigration rates are running so high. So that is one benefit of our immigration, but it's still the same type of trend.
Yeah. Sure.
And Europe is Europe's worse. Japan's worse. Oh, and China's looking like dramatically worse. So China's had its one child policy, which means it's sort of following the same trends, but all the lines are a lot steeper, because the child dependency fell off much more quickly, and the old age is rising much more quickly as well.
Yeah, because I was curious about China, you know, considering they're maybe 1/6 or 1/7 of the world population, but didn't directly, you know, or participate in the war where the baby boomers were sort of spawned from. So, I mean, when did that...
They did. Yeah, Japan had a pretty big impact on China.
Oh, okay. Well, that's error in my knowledge there, but
China had, and China though had a lot of other factors going in terms of there's a great leap forward that actually wiped out a mass amount of people within China. They've had some famines and things like that. So that there is a sort of there's been swings and roundabouts, and it wasn't a smooth sailing. But really, the one child policy was the major factor that, in terms of China. And the number of workers was rising in China for a long, long time, because you just that child line just shrunk, like from being, you know, the average person having two or three children to all of a sudden having one. And that just meant that so many more resources were freed, so many more women could go to work because they weren't needed in child rearing. So much fewer. It's much easier to raise, much cheaper to raise one child than what it is to raise three. And so, they really picked up on the benefits of that for a long time. But now they're about to go the other way. It's often called a six pocket theory. Was that at one stage there you had two grandparents on either side, both only had one child, and then those two married and only had one child, and so you effectively had one child at the bottom and six pockets all sort of helping to raise that child, which is which is great. But then it goes into reverse, is you end up with one child having to look after six grandparents because they've got no other kids to help them out, to help out looking after them. So, and we're getting into that phase now.
Yeah. And I guess, is this a problem specific to each individual country, or is it more interrelated than that?
No, it's pretty broad based. Yeah. It's a very big trend across all countries, particularly developed countries. But even sort of developing countries like say Mexico, the number of births has fallen substantially in developing countries as well.
Okay. Fantastic. So I think we're on to the next trend.
On to the next trend. Yep. So then we move into female participation. So it's another demographic trend. And so in 1966, I'll preface this by saying these figures are, sometimes it's hard to get everything on the same basis. And so I'll talk about some of these in numerical terms, but I think the trend term is pretty consistent across all. So if you look, say, at the US data, in 1966, we sort of had 14% of the workforce, 14% of females who were of eligible age were out working. And then that rose pretty quickly over that sort of next 30, 40 years to sort of low 50%. And that's where it seems to have stalled. And if you look at sort of other countries, you see that same effect coming through in that, Australia, Japan, there's most developed countries have followed the same trend. So it was a big tailwind for economies. You went from having husband, in the 60s going to work, wife at home minding the kids, and then as we got more equality, and I think as well, don't discount some of the productivity gains you got in terms of washing machines and dryers and all these things like that actually freed up a lot of people's time at home. Meant a lot more women went to work, but that trend over the last decade or so really does seem to have flattened out. And so which was a huge economic boon for economies is now turning to just a sort of a neutral. It's not going backwards, but more of a neutral factor. One of the parts, and depending upon how you want to measure the data, I have seen ones for Australia that sort of show that there's still some rising effect of women in the workforce, but actually it's quite possible that relates back to property prices rather than, and sort of people being forced to work to afford property as to rather than a sort of underlying demographic trend. There's a needs based as opposed to a wants based.
We'll be back with the investment insights very shortly. Nucleus Wealth is an active and passive investment manager. If you like what you're hearing and want some help with your investing, we can do it for you via our active portfolios. Our tactical and core portfolios use the insights shared in this podcast to construct and manage your investment. We blend tactical portfolios to offer our combinations of international shares, Australian shares, government bonds, and cash. We vary the asset allocation with the goal of protecting your capital in times of market uncertainty. We also have active international and Australian share portfolios. These are chosen using our quality and value investment philosophy. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
Fourth trend, rising debt. Now, we've got been from a period in terms of public debts. Now, I've used Australia, but you could follow this through for a lot of other countries as well, in that there were significant debts back in the sort of around the Second World War, which fell away quite significantly into the 70s and 80s. And now we've been through this, we're going through this next major debt cycle in terms of lots and lots of debts being built up. And the potential for I guess that sort of overlays a number of things. One is the risk that at some point we go through a debt deleveraging event and we need to pull back on spending. But I think the big issue to remember is that when you're going into debt, you're effectively spending more than what you have. Well, not effectively, you are spending more than what you have. And so that creates extra demand that wasn't already there. And so part of all this debt we've seen rising is effectively, in a way, it's the other side of that inequality equation, is that if a small group of people is accumulating all the assets, and so much so that the broader population can no longer afford, but that group that's accumulating can lend enough money so that these people can so the rest of the population can keep spending. So if we think about it from a housing perspective, I think a lot of people will look back at houses, 50 years ago, and talk about how cheap they were relative to incomes, and how the average laborer or tradie or the average teacher could quite easily afford to buy a house, whereas in many cities today, that's very difficult for somebody on a lower wage to do it. But what's happened over that time frame as well is we've generated all these extra ways to for people to be able to borrow money, so that it's like, well, you can't quite afford to buy a house yourself, but I can lend you a much higher proportion of that house. And so that's meant you still end up with the house, but it's just you're indebted to the rest of it. And so if that goes into reverse, then there's also that other signs as there's that could easily turn into a significant headwind. At the moment, though, that's still rising. So a rising debt, we're still spending more. That's still taking over. So still a tailwind, but you have to question it. At some point, that's you will reach the limits in terms of debt.
So, Damo, I'm just curious. It sort of looks like around the sort of 1970s, it really started to take off. Does that coincide with coming off the gold standard, or is that just sort of coincidence?
Gold standard probably made a little bit of a difference. There's the falling interest rates makes a difference in terms of it's more affordable to have more debt. There was significant economic liberalization. So there was a lot of say lending in Australia, for example. What would happen was it was rationed more by the amount of lending that banks could do. So it was sort of like there was demand for all this debt, but banks were like, well, you're only allowed to lend out so much, and so they would then be quite picky and choosy about who they would give money to. And then we sort of opened all that up to competition, and now we regulate more the cost of the debt in terms of the interest rate. And then that meant that there was the flow to more debt. So certainly the ways and we invented lots of new ways and clever ways to get debt out to people. That's a perpetual thing. People are always trying to come up with new and novel ways to shovel debt to people that they can't, usually that they can't afford. So that sort of falls into those. But I guess there's also the idea that the debt cycles do go in these quite large long-term cycles, where we had the Great Depression, debt levels were particularly high in the Great Depression, and we saw 50 years or maybe 50 years, what was that, 30, 40 years of those debt levels falling, where people were trying to get away from debt and the dangers of having too much debt, with that sort of generational thought within people's minds. Whereas the generational lesson for the last 40, 50 years is the more debt you have, the better. If you buy something, gear it to the hilt, then chances are that asset goes up and you make even more money out of it. That's what people have learned. Now that will come unstuck at some point, but that's we'll learn that lesson when it does, and then we'll go through a long period of deleveraging is my expectation.
Yeah, okay. And I guess back in the 30s, was that public debt or was that private debt? And I mean, was that property related as well? Because it seems like a lot of the debt today is property related.
Yeah. Well, the line we can see, I've got the charts I've got up here is showing Australia, and so it varies by country. So Australia's got a particularly large private debt burden at the moment. So the things we can see there is the 1890s was a massive housing crash in Australia, and so that sort of took 30, 40 years to play out before we started seeing debt levels rising again, and that was sort of just at the end of the Roaring Twenties and just into the Great Depression. And then from there, private debt sort of fell away. The public debt actually took a jump in the couple of different jumps it's taken, but one of them was, you know, post the Great Depression in terms of trying to help us get out of the Great Depression. But then we had wars as well, Second World War in particular, that sort of pushed it along as well, before economic boom and sort of then tailed that growth away.
Yeah, and I guess the question for me in my mind is, you know, what's going to make all this come unstuck? Because we've had a global financial crisis, we've had COVID, you know, these pretty massive events, and the government seems to step in and bail everybody out. I mean, is that sustainable forever?
It's sustainable for a long time. The question is, it's a valid question, is it sustainable forever? My gut answer is no, but I guess remember these things move in very long cycles. And so it's one thing to identify that, hey, debt's really high, and particularly in Australia, private debt, and that's unsustainable, can't stay there forever. But you could have made that argument any time in the last 20 years, and 20 years is a long time to be waiting for something to happen. So I think for us, it's more about, I guess recognizing that we're getting more growth than what we should have for our economy because people are going into debt for it. There are limits to how far that debt can go, and it does create vulnerabilities so that when you have crises, those crises can be much worse if you've got debt, and in particular if you don't have central banks stepping in. Now, in the financial crisis, you're right. Particularly banks. We're bailed out, and we didn't see a lot of people. Hardly anyone went to jail over it, and so arguably the lesson to learn is that you should just pile up on debts, and if things go wrong, well, you wait for your government bailout. So I think the recognition though that we're getting close to the limits of how much more debt you can add. Now, we might bump along the top for a while, but the idea that you can have this extra, you can have this, think about you go ahead and get a credit card and you've got a $10,000 limit. Well, for the next 10 months, you can spend $1,000 more than what you usually spend. So that's great. But at the end of it, you've hit your limit and now you've got to go back to your normal spending pattern. And so I guess that's what we're saying is as you're racking up that new credit card debt, you've got an extra $1,000 worth of spending, and that $1,000 is bouncing around the economy and is helpful for everyone else. So there's one part is, okay, you no longer have that $1,000, so therefore your income slows down and spending in the economy slows down. The next side is, well, actually maybe one day you actually have to pay that back and at that point you need to actually start, you need to go negative $1,000 or, well, given interest rates, you're probably negative $1,500 a month before you to eventually pay that off over that period.
Yeah, well, it seems like there has to be a point where it either, unwinds, or maybe it's just a slow grind back to something more sustainable.
Yeah, but I guess I'll just reiterate that point that don't look at this graph and decide that's it. I have to be a zero weight everything, because that could stay up there for a long, long time. And it has already. So.
Yeah.
Next one, falling taxes. So now I'm talking about corporate taxes here, and the same is true for income taxes as well. Part of that inequality factor, but I do want to talk about falling taxes on companies. So again, this is a chart over the last 50 odd years, showing that the median OECD, which is the developed countries, so median developed country corporate tax rate 50 years ago was 50%, and now it's closer to 20%. And what that's meant for companies is there's actually been a pretty reasonable amount of the earnings growth has been down to that the effect of those. So if I put in a broad sense, you've had about you've had EPS growth of about six and a bit percent. So two of that came from like real growth from earnings, and reductions in shares. 2.8% of it roughly came from inflation. So that sort of gives you almost 5%. And then about another 1.3% of it was just because of the tax cuts. So if you think about it another way, about a quarter of all the growth we've seen over the last 50 years has been because of tax cuts. And so, again, there's probably a limit to tax cuts. There's probably a limit. You can go to subsidies, I suppose. So you can keep going the other way. You can come out. Yeah, you can have negative taxes. Hopefully we're not getting there, but this is a trend which is so it's been this great tailwind for companies that you've got this extra 1 and a bit percent growth every year just from these falling taxes. Not in every year, but it's been, you get it in drips and drabs. It really doesn't look like changing much. I mean, it was only a few years ago we had the Trump tax cuts for companies. So long term trend. Probably not changing. You probably had most of the gains out of it, but not to say that you can't eke out a few more gains as taxes keep falling for corporates.
And so, Damo, this is just for corporates, but what's sort of been the trend for individuals? Like, is it similar?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. You've seen that the top marginal tax rates in particular have plummeted. Mm-hmm. So the only thing though is that often, I mean, the issue you see in Australia in particular, and another of the countries have the similar factor, is that you do have the different brackets, and that naturally raises your average tax rate over time. And so if you think about it as people's salaries are gradually growing, and so more people are in the higher and higher brackets as time goes on. And so oftentimes when there's a tax cut and trumpeted, looks at all this money we're giving back, often what it's doing is just taking that line that might have risen and risen and risen and then bringing it back down to where it was and then doing the same again. But certainly over time, income taxes have fallen.
Yeah, and there's pretty broad-based tax cuts planned for the 1st of July 2024. I think it's going to affect...
Not that broad. Mostly at the upper end.
Well, I understood it was going to affect sort of 90% of wage earners.
Right. I think the biggest ones are all coming for the top wage earners in this pack, but there's more coming. Yes, there's certainly more coming in Australia.
Mm.
So if they do end up being pushed through.
We'll be back again shortly. If you like what you're hearing but want a low-cost passive option, Nucleus Wealth is the first to offer passive direct indexing in Australia. The first generation of passive investing was index funds. The next gen was ETFs. Now, direct indexing is here with significantly more customization and control. The benefit of direct indexing is you can add or subtract investment themes, and we have almost 100 different options to choose from. For example, you could buy an international share direct index portfolio that excludes fossil fuels and arms manufacturers and has a tilt towards cybersecurity and cloud computing. Alternatively, you could buy a portfolio with no screens and an extra exposure to nuclear power and defense contractors. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
So now this is what has started to go backwards. So we had a 40 or 50 year period where we went from sort of 20% of, and again, this is different measurements, but 20% of merchandise trade as percentage of GDP, right up to sort of 50%. And then we really have seen that flatline for the last little while, and arguably is on a downward trend. So trade is typically a good thing economically, insofar as I have two people and both of them walk away thinking they got a good deal. Usually there's it means we have countries specializing in one thing and others. Now there might be reasons why you do want to actually have less trade and you want things to be a little bit more expensive. Say, the pandemic reminded everyone that just having the cheapest goods may not be the best thing. Sometimes it's about reliability and saying it might be worth paying a little bit more for something if it means that it's produced closer and you don't have to worry about not having access to that if something goes wrong. But there is clearly a backlash against China in particular. There's clearly lots of policies that are driven towards reducing the amount of goods coming out of China and Russia as well from many of the Western countries. And so what was a pretty good headwind for 30, 40 years has now turned into at least a pretty good tailwind for 30, 40 years has at least turned into a bit of a mild headwind, potentially could be a significant headwind to economies over
time. Yeah, and I mean, this onshoring trend, do you think that's going to continue, or is that just sort of a knee-jerk reaction to COVID?
No, it's absolutely going to continue at the moment. So in terms of companies, I think knee-jerk is probably, I think that there's probably been more of a knee-jerk than people realize in terms of the amount of capital expenditure that's been diverted away out of China. So China in the last couple of months has had some of the first negative foreign direct investment that it's seen in sort of 30 or 40 years. So the effect though isn't immediate for that, but it really is about saying, if I have a factory that I built in China and I've got people working on it and it's been going for 10 or 15 years and it needs a big upgrade, well, maybe I'm actually not going to upgrade it in China. Maybe I'm going to try and automate all the processes and build it in the US. Or I'm going to, automate some of the processes and build it in Mexico or Vietnam or somewhere else. And so, but that's not an instant turnaround on those. That this just takes a while, but it's very clear in the capital expenditure statistics that it is happening. It's not very clear in the actual export statistics as much, but I think what we will, that the fact that so much capital expenditure is being spent elsewhere, I think will clearly mean that we do see that.
Okay, excellent. And on to energy costs.
Yeah, so I've spoken about this one a few times on the podcast. I'll just highlight the chart on the left is just showing a long-term trend. It's actually not even up to anywhere near, it's sort of a decade old as well. But it's just showing how extreme the fall in the cost of solar was. So solar power was basically a cute technology that you'd use on things like spacecraft or things that cost a lot of money to get somewhere and you didn't have another source of power. The cost falls you've seen in that has just been incredible. That has now led to the point where that solar is the cheapest, in terms of during the day, it's now the cheapest producer of power. We do need power systems that can handle batteries that can store that power though. So you do need some sort of battery system or sources to store that. And we are seeing some pretty dramatic falls in those as well. The whole Ukraine war has really spurred that on. So we're just seeing some massive records falling everywhere in terms of the amount of solar and not as much wind, but certainly solar power that's coming on and the amount of battery storage that's coming on. And so for my part, and the bigger point as well for that is solar power is more about the having the factories that can produce the actual solar panels. So that a lot of the scaling up we did over the last year or so since Putin attacked the Ukraine has been more about creating greater capacity to produce more solar panels. And that's now coming through. And so that snowballs. So the fact that we built so many solar panels, so many more solar panels this year than we ever did, well, there's more factories coming on. And so the chances are that next year and the year after, that's going to keep going. Meanwhile, the solar panels stay in that we just put in, still stay in production. And so you do get some exponential growth. And we are starting to reach that point where, the levels are still quite low, that in terms of renewables as a proportion of the total, but they are going into that exponential growth phase. And the factories that are producing solar panels, are unlikely to then just suddenly switch off one day. Then chances are they're just going to keep pumping these things out, and we're going to see further price declines and further price wars. And so, it looks to me that absent some short-term disruptions like we saw with the Ukraine war, that energy prices are by and large pretty close to have peaked. And so, for example, if you said, okay, coal, we're running out of coal, coal prices should be going to $300 a ton. I'm like, nah, there's no way they're going to $300. No, there's no way they're sustainably going to $300 a ton. They might spike there if certain things happen, but at $300 a ton, it is economic to have solar panels plus batteries. And that level is just dropping year after year after year. We're not there yet for solar plus batteries, but we're certainly there for solar. And the solar plus batteries is really not that far off. We're talking 5 years, possibly shorter if we see some of the trends in price falls we have over the last year. So energy costs coming down. Again, a big sort of investment theme that sort of runs through portfolios over the it's been this hasn't been a long-term trend, but this is about to become a long-term trend over the next sort of 20 to 50 years, is this idea that capped energy prices and quite possibly falling energy prices.
Excellent. And Damo, you're talking about the cost of solar dropping so much. Is that, I know China's one of the largest producers and they've got a lot of subsidies, are other countries able to compete, on price with China, or are they?
At some points they are. I guess the issue is now, and what the interesting thing with this is, there's a few things. Let me start with a couple. Countries are trying to put in local processes, and whether that means subsidizing themselves or at least having government contracts and things like that to actually try and produce locally. That's certainly a thing, particularly in Europe, they're trying to do that. The cost of, and what's aiding the problem, what's aiding that issue is that the cost of solar is now low enough that it doesn't really matter as much if you're, say, 20% more expensive than the cheapest. If I'm building a massive solar farm, I'd like to be, I'd like to have my things 20% cheaper. But the net effect in terms of an economic cost across the whole energy sector, the cost of solar has now fallen to levels where it's so small that, another 20% cut in the solar price doesn't make as much difference. The big effect is actually going to be the batteries. That's where we can really get some bang for buck. Because a 20% fall in batteries, because they're so much more expensive at the moment, means that makes a much bigger difference. Now, battery technology is going in, 30, 40 different ways. It's pretty clear we will end up with some quite distinct different battery parts where the technologies used for home batteries are going to be very different to the ones used in cars. Now, that has already started to happen, and you will see some differences there. But you'll also see just different chemistries and different types of batteries, which means that you're going to have to keep investing. If you've got leadership today, so you've got a country that's got leadership in batteries, and probably China is one of those countries. It unless it's out there continually investing, it may not have the leading technology of tomorrow. So solid state batteries, for example, are very, very close. They're in, they'll be out certainly in production. They're already in some production already today. They're in the scaling up stage. They'll be in a sort of much more broad production over the next 5 years. If you're completely wedded to one type, you're going to miss this next type. And there's other different technologies coming after that, whether it be ones that use more sodium or ones that use less of some of the rare earths or you know, other different factors, so that everyone's out there trying to come up with the next greatest thing. I think there's going to need to be, I wouldn't bet on China necessarily being the leader in that in 10 years' time, particularly with some of the, the political things that's going on in terms of trying to reduce the technology that's sent to China. So they certainly may well be. I'm not ruling it out, but it's going to be much more difficult for them to maintain technological leadership in there than what it has been over the last sort of 20 odd years, where China wasn't seen as much of a threat and they were sort of allowed to sort of expropriate sort of technological ideas from other countries without too much pushback.
Okay, excellent. It's obviously a trend that's going to continue into the future. And now we've got our question of the week. So this is for viewers to have some discussion in the comment section over the coming days. And the question for this week is, what mega trend have we missed? So feel free to post your thoughts, engage with us and some of the other viewers over the coming days. And Damo, back to you for investment implications and a bit of a summary.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Sam. So I think I've got some more energy costs. So the big seven, sort of these long-term macroeconomic trends that we want you to be thinking about. So the inequality was this huge tailwind for economic growth. Has been a headwind for economic growth. Sorry. Inequality has been increasing. It's been a headwind for economic growth. It doesn't look like changing. It's probably still going to be a headwind. We had demographics and women in the workforce and rising debt all sort of adding to economic growth all at the same time. So as fewer babies, dependency ratios improving, more women working, people spending more than what they're earning is all helping. At the same time, falling taxes helped to push along. Now, of those, the demographics has turned the other way. Women in the workforce has turned neutral. Rising debt is probably still rising, but we must be getting close, and certainly the rate of growth has slowed. Taxes are still falling. Then we get to trade, where trade has turned and started heading the other direction. And then this new trend of falling energy costs, which we think is going to be impacting sort of macroeconomic policy over the next little while. So net, it does point to a less sort of attractive investment environment than we've seen over the last 20 years, but certainly not as long as you're sort of avoiding some of the worst places within those, particularly say some of the ones that are demographically challenged, that there's enough sort of headwinds and tailwinds sort of crossing each other out that mean it's probably still going to be a reasonably attractive environment, just not as attractive as what we've seen over the last 50 odd years.
Excellent. Thanks, Damo. Very insightful. I'm sure the viewers got lots of value out of today. So thanks for sharing your insights.
Excellent. Thanks, Sam.
So we do welcome your feedback on this podcast, especially in regards to suggestions for future topics. If you do have any ideas, please drop in the comment section below or send us an email at contact@nucleuswealth.com. Also, if you know of anyone that might get some value out of today's episode, we'd really appreciate it if you do share it with them as well. From myself, Damien, and the rest of the team at Nucleus Wealth, thanks for watching and we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye for now.